Hey, good day. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. I see I'm going to remember it's the OIG Roundtable because we're all together today, and that makes it the OIG Roundtable. So, great episode. I think we got a lot of great topics, joined by the full group today. Wade McFall, also during the winter known as Chris Kringle because he's in Wisconsin, and there's 9 feet of snow, and the wind chill is negative 75. So this is Chris Kringle post-Christmas, trims the beard down, getting ready to go. I always say former implies something nefarious. Retired ASAC, assistant special agent in charge from LA. Jason Eisengrind with me as always. Retired senior executive from the OIG. Retired from the UPIC West. And Matt Kachansky, also an executive from HHS OIG. Retired from HHS OIG and the retired UPIC Northeast director. I am still Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse here. Thanks again for joining us for another great podcast. So today's topic is training and education. Training and education, it hits a lot of different things. Training and education for providers, training and education for special investigations units and the like. And then training and education to law firms and people in the healthcare space doing defense work, regulatory work, all of that. So, you know, each one of these are different. The audiences are different. We here at Advise, we've done training in all of those. We've done provider training, SIU training, law firms. It spans the gambit because all of these things are important and different for the different specialties that are out there. So Wade, I want to start with you because, you know, as from a supervisory perspective, as an ASAC, as a field agent, and even now, you're a member of one of our SIU teams dealing with a large Medicaid payer community, dealing a lot with the Medicaid fraud groups, whether it be the Mifuku, whether it be what's known as the OMIG in some states, the single state payer, any of that. A lot of it is the interaction with people who have a law degree and are doing healthcare centric work. My experiences were always that if you had a really good defense lawyer, they could have a great background as a criminal defense lawyer, but they may have not necessarily been conversant in healthcare. So you spend a lot of time kind of getting them up to speed, on some of those. So let's kind of go historically as an agent and as an ASAC. You know, did you have those same frustrations where you kind of felt sometimes like, man, if this person sitting across the table from me just understood things a little bit better, the process would have been so much smoother?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, I can say from as an agent working the cases, you'd run into that. And your hope was that at least your prosecutor, your assistant United States attorney, or maybe you're prosecuting something through the DA's office, but the prosecutor on the case, it's helpful if they've got some experience as well, because then if you do have the defense that especially in the Medicare arena, there's so much specific regulations and procedures related to Medicare that even if they have a law degree, but if they're not familiar with that kind of genre of law, it's really difficult. So if you have an AUSA who's got some experience, a lot of times they will deal with the unexperienced defense attorney a little bit more, so the agent doesn't have to quite as much. But also from, you know, the supervisor standpoint, if you have an agent who's dealing with either a prosecutor or a defense attorney who just doesn't have that experience in the Medicare or Medicaid field, in that case, you're going to have to deal a little bit more with them directly as opposed to the agent. But it makes all the difference in the world if you have experience on both sides, on the prosecution and defense. It just makes the case go so much smoother.
Yeah, that's always the challenge. You know, I know having worked, and Jason knows this very well, having worked in Southern District of New York and Eastern District of New York, there's from a prosecutor's perspective, it was always a little bit of a revolving door, because a lot of the prosecutors come from firms. They want to get some experience, go back to a firm. And so they're coming to the U.S. Attorney's Office for their 3-year commitment or their 3 to 5 year commitment. And then, you know, they're kind of going. So the first challenge was always that you were getting a new AUSA who had an interest in healthcare, wanted to get that experience. And then you've got a prosecutor, you know, who they kind of vaguely understand the issues. You got to then educate them on that. Then you have a defense attorney who comes in, maybe a really good criminal defense attorney, but now you're using all of the vernacular and having to, you know, educate them. I would always say that gets back to kind of the theme we've always been talking about, which is why do cases take so long? That sometimes that's actually the problem, is that the prosecutors are a revolving door. You know, I saw that a lot in Southern District, Eastern District. And then when I was in the District of New Jersey, there'd be a kind of a constant turnover, outside of even when there's an administration, you know, turnover. So wait, did you ever do any training and education for either the U.S. Attorney's Office or for any defense groups or defense attorney practices? Did they ever ask you to come and do that for them?
I never did for any defense offices or attorney's office. We did training for not so much the U.S. Attorney's Office as much as it was with partner agencies like the Mofuku. We would have training with them, or a lot of times if, you know, that we worked a lot of cases jointly with the FBI, and a lot of the FBI agents were great to work with. They had great knowledge, the ones that were around for a while. But you ran into the same thing there where, you know, at HHS, OIG, that's all we did pretty much was healthcare, although we were responsible for a lot of other programs. 95% of agents' time was probably spent on healthcare. So you continually were learning things and expanding your knowledge base. And a lot of times, like the FBI agents, it was a temporary, this is not what they wanted to do. They wanted to do bank robberies, and they wanted to do, you know,
sure,
intelligence, things like that. So it was a little bit of a revolving door for them as well. So we did do some training for, like I say, partner agencies, FBI, the Mofuku. A lot of times we would do some training for the back in the day, the Z-Picks or the U-Picks. We would do some training for them as well. But I really hadn't done it for defense teams.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like when you know, when you want to buy a Porsche, you go to a Porsche dealership. You don't go to, you know, a kind of all you can eat deal, right? You get that specificity of what you want, because that's where you get your expertise in that. You know, we've done some training for law firms here on the defense side the past couple of years. And a lot of that was just educating practices on all of the different types of subpoenas. And to an extent, and Jason and Matt and I just talked about this. We were out last week in San Diego at the ABA's health law section conference. And we talked a little bit about the kind of the alphabet soup of subpoenas, and talked about how, you know, understanding what the different subpoenas are can help you with shaping what, you know, the case may be about. You know, for example, if it's a OIG subpoena, there are a lot of different groups within the OIG, right? Office of Audit Services, Office of Evaluation Inspections, and the Office of Investigations, where we all work, all have subpoena authority. And knowing who's issuing that subpoena can go a long way, right? So it's understanding that, and then just educating law firms on kind of the process. What's the investigative life cycle of a case? And, you know, how do you get in front of things a little bit faster? And, you know, maybe discussions on things like the self-disclosure protocol, you know, and the like. So it really does go a long way. I know we would do training at U.S. attorney's offices constantly on things, just to kind of get them up to speed on what the latest statutes were, you know, and the like. So Matt, I want to go to you next, because, you know, a big issue in, you know, is sort of this level playing field and creating like a level setting. And, you know, you've been part of a couple of projects we've been doing here with process improvement in the SIU space, because SIUs are now getting to a point where, you know, return on investment is obviously the big nomenclature, but in the SIU space, the return on investment can take a lot of different paths. It's not necessarily tangible dollars in the door or savings, but it's potentially on operational efficiencies and the like. And, you know, having training in the SIU space can be for the most obvious of things, which is, you know, training them on how to be able to look at things like CPT codes and HCPCS codes, getting investigators conversant with that, all the way through to just the basic things like documentation and how to properly document things. So you've done a ton of these, Matt. I know when you were at the Northeast UPIC, you were very intrinsically involved in updating a lot of the policies and procedures. And then even with our projects on SIU, you know, improvements and that. So let's talk a little bit about getting that level set.
Yeah, it's vitally important to have everybody doing the same things the same way, because without that consistency and without that consistent actions being documented right, nothing's defensible. I mean, you take a case result to a U.S. attorney's office and it goes to whether it's administrative law judge or through the federal system or the state system, and the defense gets a hold of it and sees inconsistencies in what's being done or actions being done not within the standards that are established, it's gonna create havoc for the prosecution. You know, so what I was seeing, you know, when I first got to the UPIC, it wasn't a UPIC, it was five separate contracts with five separate sets of work instructions, all of them different, many of them contradictory, none of them really getting to the heart of the matter, such as if two people are doing an interview, how many interview reports should there be? Well, it turns out everybody was doing their own. So if two people interviewed Dr. X, there's two interviews of Dr. X in the file with minor differences in them because it's two people writing them. That causes chaos in a case. So it was getting to that level set of, okay, I had to, you know, take it down to one set of instructions for everybody, made it a policies and procedures manual, and then started setting guidelines for how to effectuate an investigation. When you do an interview, you do this. You have, you know, however many people there, one taking notes, one asking the questions, one interview report signed by both, all the way through to they didn't understand what an indictment was versus an arrest or a conviction versus a sentencing. They had none of those concepts in, you know, some of them did, but many of them did not. So explaining to them what the judicial process was a huge part of the training. And we, you know, we, by the end of it, we had established at the UPIC a very robust training regimen, both in terms of what you talked about, the logistics of the work, the CPT codes, what do they mean when a nurse reviews them? What do they see? How are they reviewing them? What are the LCDs that are in place and how to find those and how to research those regulations throughout time to make sure you're using the right ones? Two, we had a new employee orientation that lasted several weeks where we did a mock investigation in concert with 14 training modules on each step of the investigation, from data analysis through how to do a medical review, how to work with the nurses to do that, through referrals to the OIG, case presentations, testimony, how to do interviews, how to do on-sites. All of that is part of a mock investigation. We had role-playing and the whole bit. But I'll tell you, I don't know if a lot of SIUs can do that because of the resources needed to establish and maintain that kind of regimen.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true. And I think the important thing to understand is that, you know, when we start talking about consistencies and sort of the roadmap, it doesn't mean that every case needs to have all of these things, you know, go on. Now, you know, I will say there is a little bit of a difference between a PBM SIU investigation and a medical healthcare fraud investigation, right? I mean, the PBMs have a roadmap of seven or eight things, and that's kind of it. The purview is, it's a very narrow field, and they stick to that. So the roadmap in the PBM space is very different. So I don't want to make this is really more about the SIU space on the payer side for, you know, medical claims. But yeah, while every single case is going to have a slightly different nuance because of a different policy, whether it be an NCD or LCD, there are some things consistently, you know, the taking the notes. You know, we did some training for a payer a few years ago. There were 20 people in the room. And when I talked about documentation and notes, you know, I think whatever my question was, there were, you know, I had 20 people in the room and I had 35 answers that were all different, right? You just, you know, it's kind of this difference that goes on. And you know, some of these things are really nuanced, like the note taking. Two people taking notes, two people writing reports, who takes the notes versus who writes the report. You know, I remember once having a trial where we did an arrest on an individual. Another agent took 30 pages of notes post-arrest and went on vacation. And so I said, well, just give me your notes. I'll write up the report, which was something that I never did. We always, you know, the note taker was the report writer. And I wrote up the report. And, you know, a couple of years later, I'm on trial and I'm on the stand, and my notes, which weren't mine, but the notes from the agent that wrote the notes and my report were brought up. And there was one line in the notes that could have been interpreted probably three different ways, depending upon who was reading it. And I interpreted it one way. Now, it wasn't even a substantive. It was really a defense attorney using a defense tactic to impeach me. But it was, something benign. Defendant was wearing a blue shirt, and I'm writing, patient wore a shirt that was powdered, whatever it was. It was an innocuous kind of thing, but certainly, gave me pause. And I had been an agent at that point probably 20 years. And I did the one thing that I never did in my career, which was to write up an interview report from someone else's notes. But, this agent was going on a long-term leave, and the interview report had to be done because it was a post-arrest statement that was made. And it didn't really bite anybody. The conviction still occurred in the trial, but it certainly led to a half an hour of pain on a stand that nobody, wants to deal with. So, that level of consistency is an important piece of that puzzle.
Yeah. One of the prime examples I saw was, what do you do with your notes, the handwritten notes after the interview? Some people were throwing them away. I've got the interview report. I'm just going to throw the notes away. There was no policy in place.
So it's funny. That. It's funny you say it, and it's even funnier that. And it's funnier that Jason says it. But I worked with an organization, and they had as an actual organizational policy that once you've written up your report, the notes go away. Ooh. You destroy the notes. So the only thing that exists is the written report. And I remember working with this agency. It was a state agency, and I said, "Well, do me a favor. When you're done, can you scan your notes and report to me?" And they're like, "I can't send you the notes." It's like, "Well, why?" It's like, "Well, because we destroy them." "You what? Send them to me. I'll keep them." But no. So yeah, that's an important piece. So Jason, I want to go to you because obviously that made you chuckle from an anal retentivity, a process improvement perspective. It made you laugh. So what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that's a pretty ridiculous way to conduct business. But anyway, so from a process improvement standpoint, it's essential for an organization to be able to replicate successes and to limit nonconformities, right? I mean, that's what it's all about. And if the organization is doing its due diligence and has a quality management system or process in place, and a root cause analysis is done for a nonconformity, it usually results in a couple of things. Sometimes it's a change in process or some other procedure, but most likely it involves some sort of training. And I would say that the two things that are essential to the effective maintenance of operation is training and communication. And really, that's a redundant, right? Like, whatever the form of training is, even if it's some sort of, PowerPoint and an exam question or whatever, it's still communicating information. So those things are essential to this. And Eric, you mentioned about the presentation that we did last week. And afterwards, I had a few sidebars with attorneys that are in-house counsel. And we were talking about, educating their staff. And these are professional people. Most of them have some sort of technical license, right? Like they're doctors or pharmacists or whatever else. And the issue was, we conduct these sessions and we're not really sure if the information resonates with our team. And I said, well, it occurred to me back some years ago, I started managing and directing the staff that the organization I worked at had at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And so I got very involved in speaking to FLETC staff. And what had occurred to me is that with rare exception, pretty much all of the instructors at FLETC speak from a real world perspective, right? They did that job, they had those experiences, and now they're communicating that information. And having taken probably 10 or 12 training classes as a student at FLETC, I can say that I thought it was an extremely well-run organization, and the training was highly effective because it was very believable. It was coming from people that shared those experiences. They've walked the walk, and now they're talking the talk. And so with all due respect to, you know, in-house counsel, they might be excellent lawyers. They may have excellent communication skills, but if they don't have the real life experiences that match that training, maybe it doesn't connect as well. That would be my suggestion anyway. So I think it's really important to have people that can explain the situation and the importance of it, not just from a technical aspect, but also for what are those impacts in real life. So, right, we just chuckled about, destroying notes, or, you know, I at least internally chuckled when Matt talked about having two sets of notes, because I had the same exact experience when I got to an organization after leaving government. So really important to have potentially an outside organization come in to do some targeted training and communication.
Yeah, right. It's identifying sort of global issues, right? No one is looking to come in and tell you, well, you guys really do a crap job at everything. It's really just finding out where are the things that work well, recognizing them, and, you know, where are the things where there could be a little bit of an improvement from that perspective. So the last thing I want to talk about, Matt, I want to start with you, and then I'm going to turn it to Jason. But, you know, the importance of providing training and education on the provider side, right? So it's a little bit, so we'll talk about CMS has got a program called TPE, Targeted Provider Education. And what that really means is that providers go through an audit, they get a round of education to try to fix the problems that were identified by the MAC for that. You get to get a second round, you basically get three bites at the apple. So you get to have an audit, you get to be educated, you get to have another round of audits, you get more education, you go through three rounds of that. And if you aren't straightening up and flying right, then the negative is you get put on a prepay for all of that. But, you know, the importance of this is the ability to provide training and education to providers to understand that there's a 360 degree review of things, meaning, you know, and we started beforehand, I was telling you, Matt, the story about how I was once talking to a provider who couldn't understand why he was getting all these denials on post-pay audits. And I said, well, tell me what you're doing. And he said, well, you know, I'm documenting my treatment and then I'm circling a code. And I said, but the problem is that you're not coding to your documentation. You are documenting to your treatment and then coming up with a code that you think is right. He had a big problem with his E&Ms. And he said, well, I'm documenting what I'm doing. And I said, great, but it's a 360. You have to kind of understand this full thing. So, Matt, I want to go to you, and then I want to turn to Jason. Is this, you know, this premise of the importance of this training and education, but just, you know, CMS really wants providers to document things to get paid properly, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they are very focused on lowering the error rate, you know, which is, you know, their interpretation of program integrity is if you lower the error rate, which is an overall estimate as to how accurate claims payments are across the spectrum of specialists, specialties, code types, geographic areas, and things like that. And they've got a contractor that all they do is they calculate that error rate. And so what they have done is they've made a major focus on helping providers understand what needs to be documented to substantiate what they are claiming on their claims, what codes they are using on their claims. So you talked about making the code commensurate with what's documented and what has been done. CMS kind of turned it on its head. They saw it with E&Ms and things that the documentation wasn't matching the code. So their instruction to the providers wasn't to change the code. It was, here's the proper documentation to use to substantiate the code that you've been using. So the error rate goes down, but I don't think the overpayment has gone down. I think it's just masked right. What's being done. Right. What we would do at the UPIC, and Jason, I'm sure it was the same. Anytime we had any type of an overpayment action, we had an overpayment and education letter, usually 25 to 30 pages of education to the provider as to here's what you've done. Here's what the regulations are. Here's how it should be done. Not to the point of telling them how to bill, but showing them what the rules were and how they violated it.
Right. So Jason, I want to give you the last word on this, because obviously the training and education piece for providers, for those that are intent on committing fraud, training and education has no value, right? Because if your intent is to commit fraud, then you don't really care what anybody's telling you to do as far as how to do it the right way. It's really, I think training and education is really for those that are in maybe the waste and abuse piece. If there's no intent and it's just, you know, a little bit more of we didn't understand, and so there's maybe some wastefulness, whatever. From a managerial perspective, which do you think is the better use of resources? Is the better use on resources training and education, or is the better use of resources just working to conduct the audits and then seek the overpayments and, you know, let that be the training and education?
Well, I don't know that there's any exactitude to an answer. You know, it's a chicken or an egg situation. Like, what starts first? What comes last? I would say that you have to have the training in place, and the training is an expensive proposition. So I can say that in another organization, we did some intensive time studies on the amount of time employees are spending on the task that they were assigned to do. And, you know, if it was 70%, I think at first 70% was, oh my gosh, so 30% of the time they're not doing that, the task that's in the job description, that they are training, they are mentoring, they are doing any number of other tasks. And the reality is that, you know, that could be the case, and there might be a reason for that. And there are different ways to measure the amount of training, and it can be very, so I like the term of art that CMS uses, the targeted training, because it, let's say you have technical staff that are nurses. Well, if you utilize something called inter-rater reliability, over time you can see who needs more training than someone else. So rather than just assigning it to every staff member that here's the amount of training that you're getting, what might be needed for one person is just not at all needed for another. And so you can start to minimize costs and time down from work-related tasks in that fashion. So it's not a one-size-fit-all or a process that you can just let it run on overdrive. It's got to be actually targeting the situation that you have. So if you have nonconformities, it's probably going to generate training.
Right.
So Wade, let me ask you something. What kind of a referral would you rather have? One where the overpayment letter just got sent, or where the provider has documented evidence that they've been trained on what's right and what's wrong, what they were doing was wrong, and that they didn't improve it?
Well, the later for sure. If you're talking about like a criminal referral, right, criminal case, I mean, without a doubt. And I mean, there's all kinds of other reasons also, as you know, why if the overpayment was paid back, that really affects a criminal case as well. But if you can show that they were educated and they went back and did the same thing, that's, you know, we always talk about the hardest thing to prove in a criminal case is intent, and that goes a long ways right there. If they've had that training to help you prove that intent, they pretty much handed it to you on a platter.
Yeah, those are great. And that's why I think that the TPE piece has the ability to work kind of, it cuts both ways, right? Like, so providers are going to get this targeted probe education, right? So they probe sampling and they do all that. And, you know, it's, there's something to be said about that if you're looking to get a provider to straighten up and fly right. But if you've educated a provider and you have documented proof that the provider has previously been educated about this issue, the intent piece now comes into focus a little bit better than it did, you know, maybe 6 months or a year ago. If you've got somebody who's been educated on something previously and they're still continuing to do it. Now, it may not lead to a criminal case, but it certainly shows that this provider knew or should have known, right? That civil standard that they knew or should have known because they've been warned about it, basically. So yeah, that's a great point. Well, another exciting time has come to a conclusion. Education really is an important piece, whether it's providers, whether it's the law firm community, the legal community, SIUs. You know, somebody that I know once said, all training is good, even bad training, because it at least teaches you what you shouldn't be doing, you know, along the way. I'll let you three guys figure out who once said that. So, you know, thanks again, always. I appreciate the time. Again, for those of you that aren't getting our newsletter, feel free to send us an email at hello@advisehealth.com. You can get our newsletter each week. You'll see our monthly LinkedIn Lives get published there. We'll be doing another LinkedIn Live in April. As always, it's a great pleasure having you guys on. I enjoy the time we spend together. For those of you that are tuning into our podcast, if you've missed any of them, you can always catch them on our YouTube channel. Just take a look, search for Advise Health on the YouTube channel. You can also get these podcasts as an audio on Spotify. So glad everybody could make it, and we'll see you at the next one.
Thank you all.
Thank you.